It is good to be here. I want to talk about, I'll give you the road plan for the three lectures right at the start. I was told many years ago by a good friend of mine, actually, who lives not far from here, Professor Richard Muller at Calvin Theological Seminary. I was privileged in the mid-90s to spend 6 months as a visiting professor at Calvin College. I got to know Richard very well, and I remember Richard telling me that the task of the historian is to make things more complicated. That is the burden we have, to take things that appear on the surface to be very simple to explain and demonstrate that actually they are the result of an interesting confluence of a series of complicated, complex factors. And so what I want to do in the first two lectures, the one this evening and then the one first thing tomorrow morning, I want to lay out the dynamics, really, of how we've come to the position we have arrived at in Western culture, specifically relating to matters pertaining to the sexual revolution and to the current issues surrounding the LGBTQ+ movement. And I wonder, in doing that, I don't want to discourage you necessarily, but I want you to help you realize that because these things have no simple and no recent cause, the solution to them is not a simple or an easy one either. And then in the final lecture tomorrow, I want to talk about things the church should be thinking about doing as a way of addressing these kind of issues. So really first, two lectures on historical kind of material, analysis, historical analysis, cultural analysis, final lecture on proposals as to how we might think about addressing this in our culture. It is a strange, in many ways, strange situation for me to be in. My background lies in Reformation history. My PhD was on the reception of Luther's text in the English Reformation. My postdoctoral work was, really, I focused a lot on the reception of the medieval theologian Thomas Aquinas in English Reformed Orthodoxy, specifically the thought of John Owen. So how is it that I'm now here before you tonight, having written a couple of books on the sexual revolution, talking about these issues? Well, a note of personal testimony. It was in 2016. I received an email out of the blue from the husband of one of the teachers at the local public school where my own kids had gone through school. They had graduated by this point, alerting me. He was a devout Roman Catholic couple. He was alerting me to the fact that the school board was about to become the first school board in Pennsylvania to pass a transgender bathroom and sports policy. And his question to me was, would I be willing to draft a letter with him and send it to the school board and then try to get this letter wider exposure? The only twist was only my name could appear on the letter, because if his name appeared on the letter, it would land his wife in very serious trouble. And as he and his wife are very dear friends of my wife and myself, I certainly did not want to see one of the best teachers in the school district landing in hot water. So up until that point, I'd engaged in academic controversies, by and large, and a few ecclesiastical ones. But this was the moment when I suddenly realized that, no, there are broader callings than academia and ecclesiastics at this point. And I agreed, and we wrote this letter together. You can actually find the text on the website First Things. I posted it ultimately on First Things as one of my columns there. And the letter was very gently written. We zeroed in on the issues surrounding privacy for young women, and as a secondary issue, the implications for sports for young women. And the reaction shocked me. And the reaction shocked me probably not for the reason that you're expecting. The reaction to this letter shocked me for the fact that there was no reaction. I sent it to the school board. I had a polite, matter-of-fact note back. I happened to know the chairman of the school board a little bit, and she wrote me a nice letter thanking me for my concern. I think they then went on and ignored the letter entirely. I don't do social media, so I got a young couple in the church I was pastoring at the time to put the letter up on their Facebook page to try to drum up some interest among parents. And the responses they got were ones of indifference. The parents could not see the problem. Finally, I sent it to the local paper. I mean, I was really saying, please persecute me. It was a kind of, come on, I'm here. I'm some crazy right-wing bigot. You need to pile on at this point. The local paper didn't even bother printing it. I thought I was handing him a great story about a crazy guy who was gunning for people in the township. And that struck me as deeply disturbing. I suddenly realized that people had no idea what was about to happen. One might say gay marriage was one thing. Transgender stuff is quite another. Transgender stuff, I knew, would affect everybody because it affects public places. It affects women's safety. Men were going to be, male rapists were going to be sent into the candy store of the women's prisons as a result of this. Children were going to be damaged. We live in a country, of course, where it is illegal in every single one of the 50 states for an under 18-year-old to get a tattoo. But you can be genitally mutilated, or you can be hormonally messed around in some of those states as a minor in the face of parental opposition. I realized in 2016 this was going to affect everybody. And that's why I decided to start looking into it. And that is actually the origin of the two books that Jason has so kindly plugged at the start. Please do buy them. My wife loves to buy coats. I have to be able to afford to buy my wife coats. When my wife buys a coat, my wife is happy. And when my wife is happy, I am relieved. So there you go. So that's the background to the books. One of the things that struck me was, how is it that the sentence, I'm a woman trapped in a man's body, comes to make intuitive sense to so many people so quickly? I can understand somebody who's attended Judith Butler's gender theory seminar at UC Berkeley being persuaded that that sentence makes a kind of sense. But why is it that ordinary people today, if it doesn't make sense to them, at least don't know how to push back against it? The answer, I think, is this, that it didn't happen overnight. One of the first things you learn when you study history is nothing is the cause of itself. There's always a backstory. And what I want to lay out for you tonight and tomorrow is something of the backstory as to how this has gone on. And to do that, we can't simply focus upon LGBTQ matters. I want to drill into the very way that Western society trains all of us to think about ourselves. The real problem is not the LGBTQ philosophy, ideology, idea, movement. The real problem is much more deeply rooted than that. It's rooted in the way that we are intuitively taught to think about what it means to be a human person. And that itself is rooted in transformations that have taken place over the last 400 or 500 years. And interestingly enough, when you drill into that, other things that mark our age as peculiar start to make sense as well. Why is it that civil discourse is now so aggressive and unpleasant and typically abusive? Why is it that old identities have collapsed and disappeared? Why is it that new identities have emerged so quickly? Why is it that a nation like America now has a debate about its origin? Was it 1776 or 1619? You can tell from my accent I'm an outsider. I am now an American citizen, but I'm an outsider. I have somewhat less invested in that debate than a lot of people. What interests me as an outsider is not the details of the debate, but the fact that it's taking place at all. It would not have taken place 50 years ago. What has gone on to make all of these things, not just the sexual identity chaos around us, but all of the other chaos around us, what has gone on to make this stuff plausible and even attractive? Well, in order to get at that, I want to engage, first of all, in a little thought experiment. I grew up in a county in the west of England called Gloucestershire. It's a very rural county. I now live in western Pennsylvania. In many ways, the culture and even the topography of Gloucestershire is not dissimilar to the culture and the topography of western Pennsylvania. Imagine growing up there. Imagine growing up there in 1200. If I'd wandered into town and met you in 1200 and I'd asked you, who are you? The answer would have been simple. It would have had various aspects, but it would have been relatively simple. I'm the son or daughter of X. X is the blacksmith. Our family lives in that house down there. And I married this girl, and I met her by the time I was 4 years old. And I've never been more than 40 miles. We have pretty good stats, I think, on travel in the 13th century. I've never been more than 40 miles from the place where I was born. I was baptized in that church. I was married in that church. That's the plot of land in which I will be buried with my fathers at some point when I die. And I would say to them, and what are you going to do? What's your career plan? You'd probably say, career plan? Well, what do you mean by career plan? Well, what are you going to do when you're grown up? Well, my dad was a peasant farmer, and his father was a peasant farmer, and his father before him was a peasant farmer. So guess what? I'm going to be a peasant farmer. Think about it. You live in the 12th century. Pretty much everything about you that makes you significant is stuff over which you have no choice or control. It's fixed. And if you're born to a peasant farmer or to a blacksmith, you can't say to somebody, you know, I have a real ambition that when I grow up, I'll be a knight in shining armor. Or, you know, I think one day I'd like to be king. It doesn't work like that. Your position in society is a given one. Now, let's continue the experiment and jump forward 100 years. You visit my home village in 1300. The faces have changed. Everybody you met in 1200 has died. But you meet somebody in the lane by a cottage, and you ask them the same question. Guess what? You're going to get the same answers. You're going to get the same answers. Because this is a very fixed world. Nothing much changes. And it's very easy in a fixed world to believe in external authorities because they seem, well, kind of fixed and unchallengeable. And it's very easy, I would say, to know who you are. Everybody else in the village knows who you are. You're the blacksmith, or you're the daughter of the blacksmith, or you're the wife of the blacksmith. You have a place that is given you, and everybody knows it and recognizes it. Students will say to me at Grove sometimes, but wouldn't that have been frustrating? And I say to them, well, let me show you how frustrating it would have been. Can I borrow your cell phone? And they, you know, they're good kids. They do as their professor tells you. They hand over their cell phone, and I put it in my pocket and I say, okay, I'll give you back in 6 months. And you should see the look of horror that passes over their face. And the great thing about, they don't know quite what to do with the English accent and the deadpan face. They have no read on whether I'm being ironic or not. And I say, how do you feel? And they say, I feel pretty frustrated. Or I feel angst-ridden. And I say to them, would it surprise you that if my professor had said that to me in 1985, I would have felt none of those things? Because I didn't have a cell phone in 1985. The need you have and the anxiety you feel is not a transcendental fact of human history. It is specifically related to the cultural circumstances in which you find yourself. So guess what? If you don't have the possibility of going to college, if you don't have the concept of going to college as a 12th century medieval peasant, you will not feel frustrated by the fact you can't get there. The world is limited, it is given, it is solid, it is secure. And one might say, you don't really count for very much. But that's okay because you're part of a community. Jump forward to today. The kids I teach at Grove City College have none of those anchors. Many of them come from good, solid homes, so they have an anchor. Mum and Dad stay together, and we have an anchor at home. But other than that, they live in this world of choice and this world that is constantly changing. My wife and I emigrated to the United States in August 2001, 3 weeks almost to the day before 9/11, the watershed moment in modern American history. I think I can put my hand on my heart and say there has been more change in American society between 2001 and today than there was in my home village between 1100 and 1300. More change. Not all of it related to 9/11, some of it. A lot of it driven by technology, and I want to talk tomorrow about how technology reshapes how we think of what it means to be a human being. But think of that, and then think of that question, who are you? When all of that stuff that was solid and constant, year after year, decade after decade, century after century, dissolves, and not only that, but seems to dissolve at an ever-accelerating pace, the question of who you are becomes a far more complicated one to answer. I'm going to talk about this a bit tomorrow, but I would suggest for all of the problems we have of answering the question today, what is a woman? That question is ultimately complicated because the deeper question of what is a human being is actually very complicated to answer today. So we see then, in the old time, identity was pretty fixed. What has happened in the era since? Well, there are numerous things that one could point to, but I want to just outline some very briefly this evening. First of all, three of the big, solid, authoritative anchors of identity have been thrown into chaos or flux in recent centuries. The family. There was a time in that medieval era when, yeah, a big part of the answer to who you are, it's the family. I belong to that extended network over there. We live in an era where if you have a dozen people in a room and ask them to define the family, you may come up with a dozen different answers. Now, the exact meaning of family has shifted over time. But never has there been a time in Western history where there has been such little consensus over what constitutes a family. And never has there been a time in Western history where families, and by family I mean mum, dad, and their children, the core, been so destabilized. When I was growing up, it didn't matter what happened at school because I could always go home and mum and dad were there and they loved me. And that was an important component of knowing who I was. When you live in a world where that is not the case, identity is rendered complicated. Secondly, the church. Church has been, of course, most notoriously over the last few decades, battered by corruption, whether on the grand conspiratorial scale of the Catholic child abuse scandal or on the myriad local problems that Protestant churches have. But religion itself is no longer the strong anger, even if you separate out the corruption. Why? Well, here I have to speak, here I have to be careful what I say, because I'm going to criticize something that I actually think is a real good. What is the real good? I think religious freedom. I do not want to live in a nation where the government tells me if I can worship, or where I have to worship, or what liturgy I have to use. Part of the genius of the American experiment is religious freedom. One of the things that Tocqueville is most mesmerized by in the early 19th century, when he comes and observes America as a Frenchman, is religious freedom. He has no analog in Europe for understanding that. Religious freedom is a great thing, but notice this about religious freedom, and Tocqueville himself spots this. When you have religious freedom, religious institutions become less authoritative. Religious institutions become less authoritative. Why? Because you get to decide whether they have authority or not. It was interesting when Jason was introducing this conference, he said, you know, it's a team effort of four or five different churches in Lansing, all of which agree on the basics, fundamentals of the gospel, and that's great. But just think about that. That means that if you go to church in Lansing on a Sunday, you have to choose which church to go to. You have to choose. No medieval Catholic ever did that. That's the church where I was baptized. That's the church where I was married. That's the place where I'm going to be buried. One of the amazing things that strikes me about the Reformation, having spent many years in my earlier part of my career studying it, is the Reformers did not have the conceptual apparatus to understand the consequences of what they were doing. If you'd said to Luther in 1510, 20 years from now, the church will be split, and you'll be the cause of it split, Luther would have said, I don't even know what the split in the church means. I don't even know the words you're using there. We now take that as intuitively obvious. Think about it. Religious institutions tilt towards consumerism, to put it in a negative way, once you have a variety of churches to choose from. Don't get me wrong, I think religious freedom is a very good thing, but it is not a cost-free thing. And one of the costs it brings in its wake is this: it makes it more difficult to answer that question, who am I? It becomes more grounded in personal choice than it would have been in the Middle Ages. And the Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor has a very interesting way of putting this. He says, you can believe the same things that a Christian believed in 1300 today. You can believe the same things that they did in 1300. But, he says, you cannot believe them in the same way, because you choose to believe them in a way that nobody in 1300 ever did. That's why I like to poke my Catholic friends by saying, even Catholics are Protestants because they choose to be Catholic today. No Catholic ever did that prior to the Reformation. They have a lot to thank us for on that front. And then thirdly, the nation. Certainly, you know, nations emerge, America doesn't emerge so much as creates itself, of course, at the end of the 18th century. But certainly for the last couple of hundred years, the nation has provided strong identity. Who are you? I'm an American. I'm British. I'm English. I'm French. That's provided a strong sense of identity. And we saw that in the war. My wife and I, when we were young Christians and we were engaged at the church which we attended, in Aberdeen in Scotland, there was a man there. His name was Sam Will. He was a World War II veteran. He and his wife, I think I'm getting this right, I think he and his wife had got married in August 1939. September the 1st, 1939, Hitler and Stalin invade Poland. September the 3rd, 1939, I think it was not the king, I think it was the Prime Minister, Neville Chamberlain, addressed the British nation on the radio to say that he had not heard back from the German ambassador relative to withdrawal of German troops, and therefore Britain was now at war with Germany. And our friend Sam, recently married, went off to war. Signed up and went off to war. Didn't see his wife for 6 years. Can you imagine that today? You get married to somebody, a couple of months later, they clear off to war for 6 years, and then they come back. They would be a completely different person when they came back from the Second World War. It would be a completely different person, yet they were still married in the late 1980s. Wonderful love story in many ways. Why did he do it? Because the nation was a powerful part of his identity. The nation, in fact, was so powerful that it had a greater call upon him than his marriage did. That's not a bad thing. I'm not putting that forward as a bad thing, but saying that was how people thought. Personal things had to be sacrificed for the common good because the feeling of common identity that the nation generated was so strong and important. Now, nations are in chaos and crisis, aren't they? Certainly in the West, I think. I've already mentioned 1776, 1619. When a nation starts to debate its origins, something pretty serious is going on in the culture relative to the power of the national myth to grip the imagination. We also notice from the 16th century onwards, as all of what I'm talking about start to take place, to which we might also add changes in economies. Farming is less important. Production becomes more important. The countryside becomes less important. People move to the cities. Families get smaller. At the very same time that all of these external authorities are coming under strain, starting to crack and crumble, the first person singular starts to emerge in literature. What do I mean by that? People start to talk about I. Great French essayist, I think Montaigne, is the first man who uses the word I more than anything else, more than anybody else. Think about that. Suddenly, the I becomes important. And what we see in the years after that, one could put it this way, is as the external stuff becomes more and more unstable, weaker, grips the imagination less, has less authority. So people start to look inward to find that stable core of identity. Who am I? I must move inward to find that out. Montaigne talks about the I, the great philosopher Descartes, of course, in a slightly different note, but talks about, you know, what can you be certain of? The only thing you can be certain of in this world is your own existence. Because you cannot doubt your own existence without affirming your own existence in the act of doubting. He moves inward. And then we see as this moves on, we move to the 18th century. Jean-Jacques Rousseau writes his great autobiography, The Confessions. What does he say in this autobiography? At the start of it, he says, "The only thing I need to do is to look inwards. The only thing I need to trace are my feelings and my thoughts as I move through this earthly sphere." The I becomes important. Of course, Rousseau, I think, will be important for the birth of the modern novel. What is the modern novel often preoccupied with? The I, the inner life, the consciousness. We get the Romantics in the late 18th, early 19th century. What are the Romantics concerned about? Inner feelings. Art shifts from being that which reflects a beauty out there to being that which summons up feelings in here. Interesting, if you listen, I'm not a musicologist at all. I have very eclectic music taste by and large. But if you listen to Bach and then listen to Beethoven's late string quartets, you know something different is going on. Bach is all about structure and order. Beethoven has different concerns. Beethoven's beginning to make that move inward. And then when you move into the great romantic composers of the 19th century, it's not really about order at all. It's about pulling on the heartstrings. It's about stirring up the emotions of the one listening to the art, consuming the art. Art becomes less about directing you outwards and more about pointing you inwards. And that gives birth to what I describe in the books, what I call expressive individualism. What is expressive individualism? Expressive individualism is this. The most important thing about you are not the externals. The most important things about you are your inner feelings. Authority is granted to inner feelings rather than externals. Use as an example, John Owen, 17th century Puritan. John Owen had 11 children. 10 of them died in infancy. One of them grew to adulthood, contracted an unhappy marriage, returned to Owen and his wife's home, and died. John Owen buried all 11 of his children. I've read everything that John Owen wrote. It took me a long time as part of my postdoctoral studies, etc., etc. He never once mentions any of that. There is a hint in a comment he makes on Job relative to the pain of loss of children. Other than that, he never mentions it. That would be inconceivable today. The most distinct thing about the pastor who's lost 11 children will be he's the man who lost 11 children. Why doesn't Owen mention it? Is it because in the 17th century people had no feelings? No, not at all. It's because they didn't ascribe the same level of importance, public importance, to those private feelings that we now do. We live in an age which has peculiarly granted authority to inner feelings. And expressive individualism is this idea that in granting this authority to inner feelings, the thing that makes us really human is this: being able to express those feelings outwardly. That's where we get the language of authenticity emerging. You know, I'm English. You know, the great thing about being brought up as a lower middle class Englishman going to grammar school in the 1970s and 80s is this. We were taught that inauthenticity was a virtue. What do I mean by that? Not expressing your feelings. Not crying in public. Not emoting about stuff. Not screaming and shouting at people. I was taught that self-control is the key to virtue. I didn't go to school to be taught to express myself. I went to an all-boys school. It was an arena of casual, relatively harmless violence, I would say. I went to school to have the individuality in me crushed. That was what English grammar school education was about. That was why team sports, rugby in the winter, cricket in the summer, were some of the most important things on the curriculum. You did not go to school to find your inner calling. You went to school to be made part of the team. That's not the model of what it means to be a human today. Now we're all about individuality. I joke at Grove that, I say, you know, at Grove, we say we're a traditional Christian school, and we are, but we sell ourselves as come to Grove and find your calling. That's our kind of sales motto. Everybody has to do that. You know, come to Grove and have your individuality crushed. That, you know, that would only appeal to a very peculiar subset of the modern culture that I think we would not wish to encourage to apply to the college. But you see what's gone on in modern society. As the externals have been thrown into flux, the internals become more important, and quite understandably so. We still want to know who we are. Where do we look for that? Helps explain, I think, a lot of modern anxiety. I was saying to the kids in class just this morning, I was trying to explain an aspect of the philosophy of recognition to them. I was making the point that when I was at school, I had 5 or 6 friends. We were real physical presences in each other's lives. And I never felt anxious because I knew what my friends thought about me. Place yourself in the online world where anybody can have a piece of you and where insults come cheap and cost free. It does not surprise me that we have terrible anxiety now. A world that prizes feelings and yet bruises those feelings so ruthlessly is a cruel world indeed. That's why I don't like the term snowflake, because I think it trivializes what actually is a real and serious problem for young people today. And that is that it is a much more difficult world in some sense to grow up in than it was when I was younger. So we move to seeing feelings as all important. And then, of course, intellectually, thanks to Freud, at a more popular level, I think thanks to the pornification of pop culture, we come to see those inner feelings as above all characterized by sexual desire. Which is an easy sell, because sexual desire, unlike other constructs that one might come up with, race, class, etc., etc., I think sexual desire is a perennial of human existence. It's why we can read the Iliad today and it still makes sense. What is the Iliad? It is a story set thousands of years ago among Greek heroes and gods. But the basic storyline is this. The storyline is one guy falls in love with another guy's wife, runs off with her. The guy who's been jilted gets together with his brother, forms an army, and heads over to get her back. It's a magnificent heroic story, but it speaks to us today because we understand that sexual betrayal is a very serious thing. You can't switch on the TV at lunchtime and watch a soap opera in America without the basic plot dynamic of the Iliad being played out before your very eyes, day after day after day. Not with gods and heroes like Achilles and Hector, etc., with relatively nondescript, mediocre people. But the plot still speaks. I didn't actually mean that as a joke, but I'm happy that you took it as well. I meant it as a cold, hard statement of fact. It still speaks because sexual desire is a powerful force in human nature and human history. And so one might say it was almost inevitable that as we prioritize our inner feelings, that sexual desire will become a more significant component of who we think we are than ever before. Freud offers the scientific rationale for this. Pornography, in whatever form, or pornification in its more banal form in pop culture, provides the constant messaging that shape the popular imagination and intuitions about the nature, status, and authority of sexual desires. The impact of all this is what? Well, I think the impact of all this is we come to think of human beings as constituted by their inner feelings and characterized by autonomy. No longer is my identity grounded in my social relations. No longer is it grounded in my binding, given community relations. My identity now flows from my desires and my choices. I am autonomous. If you're a Christian, of course, that's an easy sell too, because we see that as the basic dynamic of the fall. It has ethical implications. Say in the book, I don't regard gay marriage as the redefinition of marriage in Western culture. I think that no-fault divorce is the redefinition of marriage in Western culture. No-fault divorce makes marriage a sentimental bond between two people for the mutual pleasure, happiness, satisfaction of those two people that can be broken as soon as the contract is no longer being met by one side or the other. Children are so much collateral damage. The reason historically we have regulations for marriage, of course, is to protect children, to provide stability for children. No-fault divorce makes children collateral damage to parental whims and sentiments. Marriage becomes a sentimental bond. Interesting, I was struck reading the Christian ethicist Oliver O'Donovan writing, he's writing about the abortion debate. This is an article from the 1980s. And he's writing about having lost the abortion debate in the 60s. And he makes an interesting comment. He says, "What really surprised me was that it was the weakest argument of the opposition, philosophically, that proved the strongest one in the public debate." What was that argument? That the baby in the womb is just part of the woman's body. Basically said, I didn't take that seriously. I don't think anybody would believe that. But that was the argument that everybody believed. Not because it makes any sense, but because it chimes with the way people think about themselves and like to think about themselves. If you think you are an autonomous person, and if you think that your authenticity is found by you being able to act outwardly on your desires, and that's what's going to make you happy, that will actually change the way you think about other people. Everybody else becomes first and foremost a potential threat to you. What is the baby in the womb in that situation? A threat to the woman's happiness. Threat to the woman's happiness. Donovan's argument was we lost the debate because we did not understand that the way people thought about themselves made an inherently implausible argument from his perspective incredibly plausible and compelling. And I want to suggest, and this is sort of jumping ahead a bit, but I want to suggest that's what makes transgenderism so hard to resist. Because where this stuff really tilts is ultimately towards seeing any external authority that stands in the way of my psychological desires, convictions, feelings, implausible. But what is the one external authority we cannot get away from? It's our own bodies. You can self-identify as immortal all you want, but something else is going to have the final say on that. It's going to be your body. Your psychology will not help you at that point when the heart stops beating and the electric waves stop going through the brain. Your body is the final external authority. So, to wrap up this first talk then, I want to say what we're looking at in the LGBTQ revolution is really just one aspect of a much wider revolution in how we think of what it means to be human being. In the past, that was grounded in external relations over which we had extremely limited control. That is no longer the case. As those external relations have become weaker and weaker and weaker, we have perhaps naturally and inevitably moved inward and granted more and more authority to our feelings. To the point now where we grant more authority to our feelings than even to our very own bodies. And I want to explore another aspect of how this has come about tomorrow. I'm going to look specifically tomorrow at how technology has transformed how we think about what it means to be a human being. Thank you very much for listening so patiently.